And we are back with show 258 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and excuse me a minute, guys. I just have to go move my car, but I'll be back. Honest, I'm not going anywhere.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and come here, Bronstam. I have this guy that wants to talk to you a lot. It's okay. Just go in front of me. You're good.
And this is Bronstam from Australia, and I'm pretty sure that's everyone. Now we just need Sully to turn off in Haven.
Hmm. So we are actually, and this is very odd, this you're probably listening to this sometime in January, but we're actually recording this on, well, here in the States at least, it's the eve of the apocalypse. But Bronstam, you're down in Australia during the apocalypse, and how's the weather down there right now?
It's on the warm side, but there's expected to be a cold front coming through. When I say cold, I of course mean like, you know, giant, you know, flying shards of ice and stuff like that, you know, being carried on the wings of bat demons being ridden by a thing with a weird neck. It's weird. It's, you kind of have to be here.
Yeah, and have you actually seen Cthulhu? I believe that last I heard he was trying to scour the outback of all living things, and I thought maybe he had flown over Wollongong earlier today. Any sightings?
I haven't seen Cthulhu. My cousin said he saw Cthulhu, looking hot apparently. You know, he's you know, up on the fashions, looking good apparently. I guess it's you know, it's been keeping up with the cardio.
Well, that's good. I mean, if you're going to be the headliner for the apocalypse, you've really got to make sure you're toned.
You want to be in shape.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, yeah, so we better get this episode rolling before, you know, the eternal night falls upon Australia. So,
we don't have long before these zombie kangaroos on fire regroup and make another attack.
Yeah, it's a good thing that you've repelled the first one. But at any rate, we are going to be talking about Fringe, Haven, Burn Notice, and then Homeland. But first, Edmund, if you could please.
We will discuss absolutely anything and everything about these episodes, so you will be spoiled, but we've given you quite a bit of time to catch up in this case.
Yeah, I'd say so. And that being the case, we are going to jump right on into it, and we are going to start with Fringe, and here is the promo.
I'm just so incredibly lucky to have you.
I got everything I need right here.
Track the signal's location.
Maybe it's Donald trying to contact us.
Are you tripping?
It's a draft acid.
Most definitely.
Your secret's hidden in this lab.
She burned in the fire.
There, that's where we're going, Walter.
Oh, my.
We're here to meet Donald.
Okay, and that would be Fringe, Season 5, Episode 9. Black Blotter. While Olivia and a recently recovered Peter investigate a mysterious signal coming from a forest, Walter uses LSD to try and recall his memories of his plan to defeat the observers. Oh my. Well, I would guess...
Yeah, that's traditionally, from what I understand, not a traditional use of LSD. Tactical strategic thinking.
Now, I do have a question. I'm a new viewer to Fringe relatively speaking, and I was doing some of my research on the show, they mentioned that typically episode 19 is usually one of these bonkers, crazy episodes, and that that it's been a tradition over the seasons, and since there are short shows this year, this has become the new 19.
Yes.
Does anybody?
That's dead on.
Could you explain any of this? Like, I guess what is this pretty much the similar vein to shows that they've done in the past, where they're kind of like way out there?
It's pretty similar. What they started with? I mean, I'm
Brown Bay.
Yeah, because I don't think they did one in
they
season one. But yeah, in
I
season
think they only had 20
in season
episodes,
two they
anyway.
Yeah. Season two also involved a bit of a drug trip, and season three also involved a bit of a drug trip. There's a recurring theme there. And yeah, just using the Walter's wackiness in particular to do something like extremely out there. In season two, Brown Betty was part of this. They kind of it's mostly a kind of, you know, black and white noirish sort of thing with some musical numbers. You wouldn't think it. Lance Reddick has a beautiful singing voice.
Oh yeah, now that I think was the biggest disappointment, was when he just starts Low Spark of High Heel Boys and doesn't actually get to finish it.
And then you had season three. The episode is called the Lysergic.
Lysergic diethylamide. Acid diethylamide, but anyway.
You just knew that right off the top of your head. And I was, you know, because I couldn't pronounce that, I just took to calling it Frinception.
I am a chemist as well as a chemical engineer in the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure.
Just for those who want to know. Yeah.
As my words with friends score often shows, yes.
Yes. Yeah. But yes, the this actually was a pretty nice synthesis of the three out of our off-format episodes. I mean, it was Brown Betty, and now you've got Black Blotter, both, you know, code words for the respective drugs that they are that Walter was partaking in. And then, of course, you had the actual LSD episode in the third season. And the fourth season off-format episode was, of course, Letters of Transit, which was the introduction to the time period that they're currently in. So, yeah, this is probably the capstone of all of that. I'm thinking that from here they've got to pretty much play it straight in order to get to the finale.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, this... You know, last time that we talked about Fringe, and Gary, unfortunately, you were unable to join us at that point, I was saying how the previous episode was really starting to make the whole theme of the show from beginning to end gel in terms of this whole concept of human emotion and humanity and empathy versus the technological advancements that were breaking down our humanity. For lack of a better term. And, you know, Peter's entire journey was essentially a way of showing that and touching back on the themes from the first season. But I feel like this was, in and of itself, Walter's part of that journey because, you know, last episode was mostly Peter and Olivia. Now we're looking at Peter struggling with that whole concept of there being this other him in his head that is the person that he was before he had pieces of his brain taken out. And yeah, it's he's basically he's got the angel and the devil in his head, although I don't know if Nina and his former assistant really qualify exactly as those, but you know, one of them is trying to help him retain his sympathetic humanity and his empathy, and the other one is trying to drive him towards that insatiable curiosity that led him down the wrong path in the first place. And yeah, just for me at least, this was another great example of everything that I loved about the previous episode, but without all of the plot problems that the previous episode had. How about you, Gary?
Well, I have to say, this was probably one of my least favorite Fringe episodes, honestly. I really didn't enjoy it. John Noble usually does such a good job acting, and I suppose in some respect he is acting here, but I this dopey sort of portrayal that he gives, I feel does a discredit to the, you know, to this troubled character. And I enjoy seeing John Noble portray him that way. And when this sort of devil-may-care attitude, or at least that's the sense I got of it, didn't seem to gel with me that more. If you want to switch off Walter for a second and go to some of the other plot, there's either hints or just plot drops that I didn't quite understand. When they were going to investigate the first signal location, I guess, because they never saw the second one when the first one was running, and they saw the observers on the ground, wait a minute, there's dead observers on this ground, and the observers didn't bother to follow this up at all. It just seemed like a bit of a plot hole to me there. And also, then Peter instantly goes to the observer and picks out that, observer tech. It seemed a little odd that he'd go right into the guy's cranium to pull that out. Why? It seems like it's maybe a precursor or some sort of thing that he would go to grab for that after he's just pulled it out of himself to begin with. Why would he want to pick that piece up? And then we're again not finding out who this mystery guy is. I always blank on his name. That Walter was friends with
Donald.
When he said Donald, we still don't find out who Donald is. Meanwhile, when we do discover the observer child again, that's not Donald. You know, Donald's not there either. And it just seems all these points, I guess I'm waiting. You talked about things gelling, but this whole season has been so many disparate elements. I'm waiting to see it all come together, and I don't know if they can do it in such a short amount of episodes and make it credible for me.
Okay.
So
we've got definitely polarized opinions on this one. Bronstum, which way are you going to swing on this?
I'm definitely going to swing more to the positive. I had a lot of fun with the episode. I mean, I don't think there's been an episode of this season in particular that I've enjoyed in that particular way so much because of just the Walter was, I just thought he was gold the whole episode. That Monty Python sequence was just a great, great cap to it all. The A plot, I felt like it was like so many of the A plots that we had in season five. It's a bit like, you know, it's following up on this fetch quest, but like a lot of the later episodes, it's gotten better at using that as an excuse to do a more interesting character story. And I love getting into Walter's psyche, and I love doing it in the big weird episode. It definitely recalled Black Betty more than any of the other episode 19s, and it's about the stories and the lies and whatnot that he's telling himself in one form or another, and I really enjoyed seeing that, seeing those dilemmas play out in him over the course of the episode, and then just that really that really kind of sad moment at the end of finding out that it was all kind of for nothing, and just that dark confidence of his, of the demon on his shoulder. And then on top of that, we had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of little myth arc things. I mean, finding the Observer Child and that it remembers the previous timeline was interesting. I'm also a little disappointed that we still haven't found out who Donald is, because the longer they put it off, the more we're going to be expecting something big. Mm-hmm. When they finally get around to revealing that, like, I'm not sure if it's anyone other than Bell or somehow Walter himself, I think we're going to be a bit disappointed. I love the I wish it wasn't so throwaway, but I was still kind of a little excited when they brought back Samwise posthumously, sadly, but
yes.
But that was a nice touch. So yeah, I really enjoyed the episode.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, I'm more on the positive side as well. Certainly, I think sort of having gone through all the seasons and sort of getting used to the whole episode 19 concept helped. But also, I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, we have seen before, but perhaps not as much recently, you know, is that whole element of, you know, the sort of the pressure getting to Walter and him wanting to, you know, get away from it all for a while, basically. And just, you know, and that whole aspect of it, there's sort of being this rather poorly timed, inopportune time to drop some acid, you know, actually, actually did kind of work for me and made sense for the character. And then certainly, you know, yeah, I mean, the use of, I mean, certainly the use of the flashbacks from his actual past certainly, you know, made a lot of sense to me. Well, fleshing out, not to pun too heavily, you know, on the fire and what her role actually was in it was certainly adding things. And then, I mean, that sort of I really saw it as the reappearance, even though technically, you know, we sort of hadn't seen the original Walter, but that original Walter was just so reminiscent of Walternet that, you know, yeah, it was like having a nice little visit from that character that we love so much. And, you know, and there is still part of me that was, you know, I don't know how they could do it the way they've set this up, but if the resolution somehow involves the other side, I would be very, very happy, but I don't know if I can actually make that work. But at least having a little flash of the Walternet there was got me thinking that, you know, okay, so it might not be sort of the official other side, but we might see elements of it coming in to bring all this together. And yeah, and then the Samwise thing, I mean, of course, I mean, I sort of was disappointed with the way Samwise's arc, you know, sort of ended back in the other timeline. So you know, it was nice to see him back, but in a way it was sort of, you know, no, he's still getting a little bit of short shrift, but and that seems to be the lot for this character. And of course, as a lifelong, from the time I was a teeny tiny tot Monty Python fan, the whole Gilliam sequence was just an absolute joy to behold. You know, because I immediately had to do the research because it was so seamlessly done, and discovered that, you know, no, I mean, obviously it was with his blessing, but no, I mean, it was their own animation team just going in and crafting this extremely loving tribute. Terry Gilliam himself was not directly involved, but you certainly couldn't tell. You know, I really like the way they actually maintain this tradition, you know, but still managed to draw things forward. You know, even. even if in the tradition of this season it was still a bit of a fetch quest, but you know, at least with a more satisfying conclusion, I thought.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wondering, Gary, if this is one of those examples of, I don't know that you've gone back to see any of the first three seasons. I think you only saw season four?
Yes.
Okay. Because certainly Walter's drug habits were a lot more prominent in the earlier seasons. At least his references back to what he used to do would be at least once an episode, and there'd always be some odd, you know, perceptual change that he would be pushing on everybody. And, you know, I think, yeah, in fact,
something odd that he was eating or imbibing.
Yes, exactly. If I recall correctly, in the pilot, the whole thing that happened with Olivia was it involved her going into the isolation tank, but there was some kind of drug cocktail that he was injecting her with in order to change her perception. So it's always been in the DNA of the show, but in the fourth season, with so much going on and the timeline shift and everything else, I don't know that they really retread that ground very much. And it, with the exception of, I can't even really say that, each of the off-format episodes so far have really been, have included or have been focused on Walter and a shift in his personality or perception. You know, Brown Betty was him seeing the world, you know, basically stoned out of his mind. And it was, yeah, he was seeing the world as a story and, you know, as a musical and in some very odd ways, and that didn't necessarily work all the time. And then the LSD episode in the third season was done basically in the style of a Scanner Darkly. It was animated, most of it. So, and then, of course, in the fourth season with Letters of Transit, he had part of his brain missing, and then when it was restored, his personality shifted. But, you know, Etta was more of the main character in that one. But it is something that has always been there, and it just hasn't been as prominent as it has been in this episode, which may be why we had a completely different reaction to it, because we've seen this before.
Yeah,
as
I mean,
said, yeah, it's kind of part of the character.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. I mean, I see, like, as you said, the Monty Python-ish thing was fun and cute, and there were moments, especially me being a Disney fan, seeing the little Tinkerbell pop out. I mean, it wasn't with that, it was completely without merit. It's just I've come to expect something different, which obviously that's because I've been a short-term fan. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, yeah, I this should be interesting to see how this all falls out in terms of the scoring. I'm going to say I gave this one a 10. I thought that this was building very nicely on the previous episode. And as I said, maybe coming from someone who's been watching from the start, I really feel like they are layering in a lot of the concepts that they've had since the first season and that they've carried through all this time. And they're really pushing it in these episodes to show that they are trying to bring the show together full circle, and wrap it up with a nice little bow. And yeah, this was just a knock out of the park for me. How about you, Edmund?
We feel more comfortable with a 9. No, I thought very, very good, but I still want to give him a little bit of room in these next last few episodes.
Right. Okay, Gary, hit us with it. What are you going to give this one?
I'm going to give it a 7. I mean, it was good. I just think they could do better. Everybody could do better. The storyline could have been tighter. It seemed like this whole, as you said, the Nina Carla sort of dynamic just fell a little flat for me. That this quote quest to find the observer kid. So they went to one place and they had to get another frequency and then they walked to someplace else. It didn't seem like much of a quest, so to speak, as some of these other things have been. There really wasn't an obstacle to overcome, at least in my opinion, other than the guy on the porch with the rifle. But so yeah, 7. It had its moments. So like I said, there were cute things with the whole drug influence, and even the storyline did get pushed forward. We finally found the observer child, and we got, you know, a little bit more sense of some of the lengths that that Walter had to go through to set up this plan. But it wasn't firing on all cylinders for me.
Mm-hmm. And Bronstam, how about you?
I would agree with Edmund. I'll go a 9. It was it was crazy good, but it didn't quite reach, I don't know, it didn't quite get over the top for me.
Okay, fair enough. I'll tell you, Gary, you know, Henry, who also independently reviews Fringe on his own, gave this one a 7 as well. So you're not alone, but certainly this one did come up well above average. But it still is the bullet that saved the world that is carrying the torch for this particular season. But I think that an average of 9.6 is going to be hard to beat.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, we are going to shift gears quite a bit here and move into Haven. And here is the promo.
Sci-Fi's original Friday. Audrey's time draws near.
I only have a few more days left before I disappear.
And Haven's time runs out.
What the hell is happening here?
I don't remember anything.
You're a monster. You're the Skinwalker.
Okay, and Gary, why don't you go ahead and take the recap for this one?
Sure, absolutely. We're talking about Haven, Season 3, Episode 11, Last Goodbyes. As the time of her 27-year disappearance draws near, Audrey wakes up one morning and discovers that everyone else in Haven has gone into a coma, except for one man. Who could this man be but a complete stranger we've never met before? I'm really surprised they put what I consider a bottle episode in this late in the season as we're reaching to a close. It was a cute trouble of the week, I want to say. I guess it gave Audrey a bit of reflection time. Not that I really think we needed it. So it just really left me a little bit loose. You know, she was back and forth whether or not he was the bolt gun killer. And, of course, he turned out not to be. And, you know, we had some cute things where he would rattle off something. Oh, maybe he's a doctor. Oh, maybe he's this. Maybe he's that. And just really, gosh, I don't want to sound like a negative person this whole show, but I did not like this episode either. I enjoyed the interplay of all the characters, and we just didn't get any of that. And were they running short on time? Did they not want to let something out of the bag till the right episode? It just seems they added this on, and it's not needed at all.
Yeah, this was an interesting one for me because, as I was watching it, I was wondering why they were going through the motions with this when they're talking about this deadline coming up that's really important. They've been dropping some pretty big hints in the previous episode about how all this is coming together, and then they follow up the whole revelation of the Skinwalker by having this situation where it's almost obvious how it's all going to pan out, and then when they reveal that it's got to be somebody else, who else could it possibly have been? I mean, there's only two characters that they introduced this season. If it wasn't the one, it had to be the other. And sure enough, that's where it ended. So, yeah, to me, it felt like they spent an awful lot of time, and it wasn't horrible. I mean, it was entertaining enough, but it felt like they were marking time a little bit in this episode. Bronston, what do you think?
Yeah, they had to pad out a story, and they tried to do it with this flashback structure and jumping back and forth a bit, and I think between that and them wanting to do a wink wink nod guest star sort of thing, what happened was what came together was an episode that just there was a lot of elements that didn't quite gel, that weren't all organic parts of the same story. Part of the problem was that it is insanely obvious from the beginning who the Skinwalker is going to be, especially after the first couple of rounds of interrogations and stuff. And although admittedly, I was kind of half expecting by about just given the way that all the previous interrogations had gone, she would get into the room with the brothers, and one of them would say, "Remember that time when we almost kissed at the thing?" And I kind of expected it to go there. Given the pattern, the A story to be honest, if it wasn't for the casting gag, I wouldn't have been interested at all. I don't think it wasn't one of the more inventive troubles, and they were trying to use it as just a really transparent thing for Audrey to work through her issues about whether or not she's going to leave and her deadline and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, this was an episode that they kind of took about a half a dozen different things that they wanted to do and tried to mash them all together.
Yeah, that's about how I felt about this episode. So, I mean, it's almost like this is another example of an episode that we've been saying for much of the season now that they just don't seem to have this. The irony is that last season, we felt like it was a really good, tightly wound season, and they weren't really trying. And then this season, the network actually came to them and said, we want you to combine the serialized and episodic elements even more, and it almost threw them off their game, it seems, because they just seem to be varying wildly between the two, and they're not really coming together very well. And when you get these moments of revelation, you have examples like the previous episode, which, if you can remember back that far, we actually really liked the last episode. And then there's this one that just kind of fell flat. And it seems like there's no consistency. I mean, the last episode came in with an average of a 9. And I'm fairly sure we're not going to come to that conclusion with this episode. So it's really odd to me that the show is this inconsistent this season. It's definitely not quite as good as it was last season. I mean, it may come in with an average at the end, very similar, but I think the consistency hasn't been there. I certainly felt a lot more positive about the show at this point in the second season than I do at this point in the third.
Yeah, I'm right with you on that. I mean, it's still a really good show. It's just so very up and down. It reminds me of the second season of Lost Girl, which I think the average is pretty close to what it was for season one, but not because it had a consistent level of quality, but because every really fantastic episode was sort of balanced by one that was just boring or flat out terrible. Haven has been having that problem this year.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely agree. All right, well, let's see. What would we go ahead and give this one? I mean, our reviewer, JM, liked this quite a bit more than we did and gave it an 8, but I'm going to say that it comes in at a 6 for me. How about you, Gary?
Yeah, you nailed it exactly. That's what I was thinking, a 6, and it's almost a 5, but I'll leave it as a 6. I like the troubled premise and enough to keep it up there, actually. So, yeah, a 6.
Okay, and how about you, Brunstam?
Ooh. I'm not going to do a fraction, but I think I'm going to have to go with a 6 as well. Mm. But very reluctant. Like, I almost want to push it up to a 7. I don't know. The Uncharted fan in me is just like, no, what are you doing?
Yeah, I know, but if the character had been a little more like what we were a little more familiar with, that might have worked better. This definitely is a drop from the previous episode, but it's not quite the lowest scored episode of the season, but it's pretty close. With 2 episodes to go, but wow, I mean, we're sitting here on, the 20th, 21st of December, and we're not even going to see the last 2 episodes now until, I think it's the 17th of January. So
it's that late in January.
It's that late now,
I thought it was early.
No, I think it's the 17th now. So now we're looking at, even when this episode goes out, it's probably going to be even a couple weeks from that. So, yeah, it's going to be challenging for them to go from this to a 2-part finale with the inconsistency that they've had. I think it's going to be hard for people to come back to it with that level of excitement that they really need. It would have been, unfortunately, there were, of course, other factors involved, but it would have been much better for them, I think, if they could have just closed out the season this week like they were originally intending to, rather than have this huge gap right at the end. But there we are. That's Haven and where we're at for that for a while. But we are going to, we've kind of, prepped ourselves for the next show that we're going to talk about, which always seems to be a bit of a negative discussion. We'll see if that continues this time, and that would be Burn Notice. And here's the promo.
Thursday, with only 1 episode left before the season finale.
Mike, you get our tickets out of town?
We're not leaving just yet.
Michael Weston's back is against the wall.
I don't see a way for us to escape.
We can't take these guys head on.
You run out now, it'll be a bloodbath.
Well, this just gets better and better.
Since when do we send people to their death to save our own ass?
This is his mess, not ours.
This isn't who you are.
Mike, what the hell are you doing?
Wow, if that had actually been what the episode was like. Oh, well, anyway. Edmund, if you could please.
Sure, this is Burn Notice, Season 6, Episode 16, Odd Man Out. Michael seeks refuge in a warehouse when he's caught in the middle of a smuggler's attempt to get revenge on his former client. Survival becomes a challenge as supplies run low and the exits are blocked. Yeah, and this was our latest detour on the way out of the country. Michael and the crew have to deal with Patton Oswalt's smuggler buddy, who has the chips they need for their passports. You know, I mean, some of the actual, you know, action stuff was sort of, you know, like, you know, I hesitate to say classic Burn Notice, but you know, or let's say standard Burn Notice stuff. You know, but there's just this sort of continued feeling of them just stringing this along, and you know, on top of some, you know, rather more gaping plot holes than usual this time. I mean, after all of that Sturm and Drang in the previous episode about, you know, having to get all this money so they can get the passports, and then the, you know, in the negotiations when the price suddenly doubles, and I'm thinking, you know, well, this is going to be a problem, and then boom, jump cut to the next scene, and Sam's plonking down $400,000 on the table. Now, wait a minute. Five people, $200,000 apiece, they got $1 million. Where's the other $200,000 coming from? But I guess that was probably thinking too much. I mean, if anything, I mean, this pointed out that, you know, I actually feel like if this new smuggler, Vanek, had been the one around for the last few episodes, that could have been actually more entertaining. You know, even though I do like Patton Oswalt, I think he was starting to wear thin, which might have been some of the intention, given the way way things were going at the end. But it, you know, it's sort of this ongoing sort of feeling like this slog to the finale. You know, I mean, some of the ideas they were playing with, you know, I mean, if they'd been properly developed through this second part of the season, could have been interesting. I mean, especially the whole thing of Michael, you know, seeming to turn on, you know, ignore what everybody wants to do and want to turn him in at the end. You know, if they had been playing Mike, you know, the whole thread of Michael going darker, you know, basically, you know, since he shot Card and between the eyes, you know, could have had a lot more resonance. But you know, too much of what's been going on has just been still standard Michael Weston, that, you know, no, I mean, you kind of figure that, you know, yes, he, you know, that he, you know, he had something in mind. It turns out he may have been improvising a little bit more than usual. But once again, I mean, they're, you know, ostensibly trying to drive this continuing plot forward, but doing so with just standard Burn Notice stuff going on. And And certainly the you know, the second major plot hole was, you know, after making a big point about, you know, oh yeah, the CIA is going to be looking at Nate's grave, it's like, you know, but oh yeah, we can still have a decent emotional scene there with Maddie and Michael, but you know, yeah, no hint that that's actually compromised anything, you know.
Well,
that comes up in the finale, maybe, but you know, why should that happen?
Given exactly. What's been going on already? Oh, you thought that was the biggest plot hole, because I loved the part where they talked about how incredibly flammable this chemical was that I can't remember, and that they pour all over the floor. The bad guys stand in it.
Yeah.
Sam then lights it on fire. The stuff goes flaming in there. And stops about 5 feet in front of the people that are standing in. I was wondering, how did that work? Anyway, never mind the fact that then you had the fan that tore itself apart really easily. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway. Well, Gary, how about you?
You have to find the right model of palette.
I guess so.
Well, I kind of like this. After all the issues we've been having with this show, and there's been many, you know, it was sort of nice to have a little classic Burn Notice episode. The objective was pretty straightforward and clear. Michael had to come up with a slightly unorthodox way to, you know, to resolve the situation, and everybody got away free, and everything sort of almost pretty much a reset at the end of the episode. Not everything's got to be an ongoing storyline all the time, and I, contrary to what they've tried, I really haven't felt this show has been doing that. I didn't mind it. It was nice to sort of, you know, get back sort of in the old saddle with just this type of episode. For this show, this episode worked for me reasonably well. As you said, the scenes with Mike's mom were really touching. Even the plot holes, as you said, with actually still going to the grave aside, that was a nice little touch, and it was just generally fun. Oswald Patton was fun to watch, or Patton Oswald rather was really fun to, you know, watch as well as a guest star. So I enjoyed it.
Ron Stumpf. Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to say something that's a little more expressive than what you said last time we talked about Burn Notice.
Well, I'll agree with some of the other points. I mean, I still think Sharon Glass is easily the best thing about the show at this point, because the stuff with her has, you know, coping with Nate's death and with what Michael's doing and everything, like I think the performance is sort of saving the character and giving the episode some moments of genuine emotion. And if you can do genuine emotion, I mean, that's usually the best way to try and hook into the episode, but it's still not quite enough to overcome my frustration with the fact that it feels like they're still kind of going around in circles. Now, this was a better episode than some of the other ones we've been having lately. I mean, not by much, but it had a good villain. I'm totally blanking on what the actor's name was. I recognized him straight away and couldn't think of the name, but the bad guy was a really good sort, one of the better of his kind that we've had lately. And I did kind of like the fact that they tried to add a bit of moral ambiguity at the end, but it's the kind of thing that should come when the overarching story is, quiet and simmering, but instead we've still got that problem where it feels like this is, why are you stopping to deal with this? I mean, there should be no time for side quests.
Well, there shouldn't but that's, that's kind of what we talked about last time, is that I got to the point where I just said, for all that they keep telling us at the beginning and end of every single episode that they really, really need to get out of the country, they can't even get out of the town, let alone the country, that it really comes down to it's just another framing device to try and ramp up some tension in what are very standard Burn Notice episodes. Now, the last one I thought was pretty good once you stopped trying to figure out how it was consistent with the big story that they're supposedly trying to tell. This time I just felt like it was lazy, mainly because of some of those little logical flaws that it had that, Edmund mentioned the thing where they made such a huge point out of don't go to the grave because they're going to be watching it, and that's where they go at the end. And then, the whole thing with the accelerant that really didn't make any sense. Things like that,
I thought Sam was trying to hype it up. I felt Sam was trying to hype it up a little bit more than maybe the flammability of it actually was, just to scare them a little bit extra. It never hurts to, talk up a big game.
Yeah, but it was Fiona that was mostly worried about the fact, because as a, explosives and demolitions expert, she was the one who was saying this stuff is an accelerant and I don't want to be standing in it. So unless they kind of fed off of each other on that, which I didn't get that myself, it just felt like they were making a really good point. And if they wanted to maintain that point, all they had to do was have the three people that came in the door jump back out the door. But instead, they just stood there. Well, the flames are, going 7-8 feet into the air, and they're just standing there perfectly fine. But I just felt like this was the kind of thing that they easily could have done in one act of an episode, and it felt just stretched out. Maybe not. It wasn't quite so bad as the Revolution episode where they were in the tunnels, but... it still reminded me way too much of that.
Yeah, similar issues, though.
Exactly.
Yeah, ostensibly it was all, at least this one was sort of all related to them trying to get out. But
yes.
They needed the chips for the passport. But it still took... didn't need to take a whole hour of our TV time.
No. All right, well, I'll be honest. I gave this one a 5. It's just it wore thin for me. How about you, Edmund?
I think I was oscillating between the two coming into the podcast, but I'll drop down to a 5 as well. The more we talk about it, the more holes I'm seeing.
Mm. Gary, how about you?
Yeah, I've got to stick.
Well, I see what you're saying, and I guess that's probably going to now temper my original number a little bit. But it was still a fun show to watch. I still kicked back and enjoyed it. So I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay. And Bronstone?
I'm going to hit, nicely land right in the middle ground there. I mean, it still wasn't a particularly brilliant episode, but it felt like there was an emotional hook for the first time in a long time for me. So I'm going to give it a 6.
Okay, fair enough. It still came in below average, but it still fared better than the two episodes that came before it, which I suppose makes sense. Yeah. And I guess all we have left then is the two-episode season finale, which...
two-episode finale.
That should be fun. I wonder if that should be the MST3K episode of... our show, but I think we'll spare everybody that pain. But we'll be definitely talking about that in the next episode. But in order to close this one out, we are going to move on to Homeland. And here's the promo.
I really have a second chance.
A clean slate?
I never thought that was possible.
It cannot be with him.
Brody has kept every promise he's made to us.
He's a man who put on a suicide vest, Carrie. That's who he is. That's who he always will be.
He has no secrets now. We might make it.
Something terrible's going down. An assassination.
It is like you just don't know anyone.
You know me.
I thought you said your eyes were open.
Maybe I don't want to be alone like you.
You're the smartest and the dumbest person I've ever known.
Maybe all this will end in tears.
Allah, what about?
Is it done? I'm a guy who kills bad guys.
Carrie, I'm looking for you. Please call me back.
Oh my God.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, Bronstone, why don't you go ahead and give us the recap for this one?
All right, Homeland, Season 2, Episode 12, The Choice. Carrie is faced with a pivotal decision while Brody meets with Faber to contemplate the future of the family. Meanwhile, Saul undertakes a secret assignment, and Quinn has a decision to make that may prove to be a game-changer. So this... I don't think I've had a harder time figuring out my own opinion about an episode of Homeland as I did with this one. It didn't help the fact that it was just so divided. Way more divided than I expected. I mean, it's one thing to sort of have mostly denouement and then a big cliffhanger in the last 5 minutes, but I admittedly wasn't checking the time, but it felt like the... After the twist in the tale, it felt like they went on for another half an episode.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Oh yeah.
And that surprised me, because it also just kind of hung there. It started getting into what I assume is going to be the plot of season three, and I felt like I got like a bit too far into it than it really should in the back half of the finale of the season before. Like, I think leaving it with a cliffhanger, I think it would have been a slightly stronger move, and then suggested what we're going to see in the next season. Although it might be that they were just really, really keen to shunt certain people around before the third season. But I don't know. I guess that's the thing. I'm thinking more about the plot and the plot and character mechanics than any you know enjoyment or reaction to it. It all wound up being a bit cold in the end. Kind of going back to what we've been saying for the last couple episodes, a bit too 24, a bit too let's throw in a twist in the final, you know, just before the final act, and then have it go in another direction completely. And that division, I guess. I don't know, it made it hard for me to enjoy what was enjoyable about the episode, which was, you know, it did start putting the focus back, you know, back on the characters and dealing with the fallout, even if it did seem to be happening with an extreme amount of neatness in that first half.
Well, yeah, that my reaction to this is that it was almost a tale of two episodes. It would have been logical to me if they had had a 13-episode season, and the first half of this one was one episode, and then the second half was a completely different episode, because it really felt like two completely different shows.
Mm.
Quite frankly, for me, the first half of this episode was excruciating. It took forever, and it just kept going over and over the same thing again and again, and it just felt like, are you going to get somewhere? If this is the entire episode, if this is what it was all building towards all season long, I'm really not going to be happy with this show at all. And, you know, we've been saying that feeling like the writers were getting to the point where they were spending an entire season doing what they originally thought they were going to do at the end of season one,
right?
Which was write out Brody. And I was just waiting for the guy to pull the stinking trigger already so we could just get done and over with it. And then when they came up with that just mind-boggling thing where the guy who is an assassin, he's stone cold, he's been planning for weeks or whatever to take this guy out as soon as he gets the order, then decides, you know what, Carrie deserves to be happy.
Oh, everyone flipped on Carrie this episode. And then, except that then Saul sort of flipped back a bit later on. But it was just after being just very unstable and unorthodox, and Homeland, for the most part, taking a pretty, what felt realistic approach to the whole thing. I mean, it wasn't the Jack Bauer cowboy cut, you know. Damn it, you blew up three, you know, tankers full of gasoline and a small hospital and a, you know, planet, but, you know, you got results, so what the hell? It felt like Carrie always kind of had took the rap for the stuff that she did and generally kind of kept going to a worse and worse place. And yet, in the first half of this episode, everyone's just turned around and was just like, she's the best intelligence officer I've ever seen. Which is like, yes, because it's clearly a hallmark of, you know, quality in the field to sleep with, you know, terrorist congressmen. You know, I'm pretty sure that's in the manual.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that really annoyed me. And I was just, again, I was really prepared to hate this finale because that first half.
Yeah, and I mean, I mean, I agree with everything you said about that part of it. I mean, you know, and what really got to me was, you know, the huge elephant in the room that, you know, you're all alone in the cabin, and you know, and quite honestly, my feeling was more, it's like, you know, yeah, okay, so they're together, they're in that place, they were happy, but it feels a little off, and it's like, because eventually you're going to talk about the elephant in the room that she, you know, Carrie, you know, he killed the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
You know? you're the only one who was actually the witness to it, now that Abu Nazir was conveniently killed. It's like, but we're just not ever going to mention that.
Yeah, and not only that, but she's going to bring it down to, well, man, I really need to make a choice between the man I love and my job.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
This is what that we watched all season long, last season and most of this season, reduces to that?
Yeah, I, and especially when, I mean, the whole tension of the character and the relationship was, you know, she's attracted to this guy, even though she knows all these bad things about him, and she knows this really bad thing about him.
You know? Well, okay.
Even before the later consequence, you know, and they don't use that or milk it at all.
But
bring that tension back.
Right. And then, okay, so this is what we were worried about from the moment that they had that 24-esque scene with Brody basically hackling over the dying vice president, and the show just took that complete left turn into madness. Mm-hmm. And yes, this is the inevitable direction that it went. Thankfully, they dropped a bomb in the show. I mean, literally.
And on that bombshell.
Yes, exactly. Boy, that I didn't see it coming.
Oh no!
Agreed.
And yet. They did a really nice job of it because everything's going along and he just kind of looks out the window and is like, I don't remember parking my car there. And just when you start thinking to yourself, what the heck is that supposed to boom? I mean, it was just that actually. And now everything that happened after that in terms of explaining why the bomb went off, that this was the contingency plan, that Brody was going to be the fall guy for all of this.
Yeah.
Made perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That actually redeemed a bit of things for me. Now, the fact that they then had that as the out, because how they were going to have Carrie and Brody in a relationship moving forward was just ludicrous. Oh. There was no way it could work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for this to be the way that they fixed that and got the character out of the picture without killing him, okay, I'll give it that. But I have to say, the second half of the episode to me was not about Carrie and Brody. It was about Saul.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
That saved this finale. The conversation that he had on the phone, every single thing he said was just breaking your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then that last scene with him and Carrie. Now, my DVR, for whatever reason, decided to record both Homeland and Dexter right after it. And I'm looking at the time going, there's a whole nother hour of this? And then it stopped there, and I was like, oh, okay, because I don't know if I could see much more of that, but it was pretty intense. I mean,
yeah, some of us then went on to watch the next episode, which was pretty intense. Like, that was an interesting afternoon.
I bet.
Yeah.
But I mean, the everything that could have happened at the end of the first season actually happened
mm-hmm.
in the finale of the second season, and maybe, what, 5 times worse. I mean, seeing all the bodies laying there and Langley in ruins, it was pretty dark place for them to go, even after having a guy watch the vice president die of a heart attack. I mean, that was comical compared to this.
Yeah.
So this was actually the show, to me, going back to where it belonged.
Oh, absolutely.
That, okay, Brody's out of the picture. Yes, they kept him around so that there may be some reason why they have to dredge him back out of the ether later on in season 3. But they've got Carrie back where she belongs. She's still on the edge as far as people being able to trust her, but most of the people that were working against her and Saul are now dead.
Right. Yeah, except, you know, yeah, then there's this, you know, the big cloud of uncertainty that's going to be hanging over her with Saul in terms
right.
of, okay, where the hell were you?
Exactly.
However, you've got Saul really stepping up into the SD's role of just being, you know, not just an authority, but being the one who's kind of a little sus about Carrie. But I'm wondering if they're also going to keep Quinn around now that he's... Mm-hmm. Well, I guess he doesn't really have a job. he probably needs a new line of work given the way that things went down with all his bosses, and he seems to be on Team Carrie now.
Mm. Yeah, well, although, I wonder if that promotion is still going to be on the table. They have a few vacancies now.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, there is still Quinn's actual boss, you know, Dara Dool.
Yes.
Lurking in the wings too. So.
That's true. Well, I do know that the producers and the writers did admit that they wanted to take things a little bit more, you know, back to the first season aesthetic, and that even though they defend to the death their character choices for the second season, I think that they do know in the back of their head, even if they don't want to admit it, that they went off the rails.
Yeah.
And I think stripping it back down to something smaller scale makes a lot of sense. I think that's the only way that they can repair the damage that they've done. And I'm sure there are going to be people that will just eat this up. I mean, but that was true for 24 too. And 24 would go really wonky. There were people that, you know, said it was the best thing ever. So I think that, you know, they are going to be able to bounce back. That second half of the episode showed me that they still had it, what it took to deliver something, and bravo for Showtime for having the bravery of just putting a disclaimer at the beginning of the episode for people who might be affected by the events in the episode, rather than just say, hey, we're going to wait a month and a half to show this. But anyway, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, this it led to this. This is resetting the show. I only wish that that this had been one whole episode versus having the first half of the episode be nothing but trash. Because I'd really rather rate and score the second half of the episode by itself. Because I'm right there with you, Bronstone, what you were saying at the beginning. I don't really know which way to go, because I think they ended on an incredibly high note, but they started off so low.
So, you know, I mean, they're a shoo-in for most improved, but I'm with you on just... The first half of the episode just descending into kind of schmaltz and bow tying and a lot of the that sort of stuff, and it's just it would have been just a really poor extended denouement, and that the second half was stronger and it reminded me more of season one and stuff like that, but that the shift was just so major and the division so strong that I have a hard time. I have a hard time enjoying the episode. Like I'm just the shift kind of sucked me out of that of like the good viewing space, and I'm sort of too. I'm thinking about it too structurally and too much about how and why they put stuff together, and I had trouble just enjoying it and figuring out its merits.
Yeah, I mean, because for that first half, I mean, just I mean, the one little element that they haven't bothered to mention because it's barely worth mentioning, but just in terms of contrast between this season and last season, you know, I mean, even in this recap, you know, where they're trying to make it a big thing about Brody meets with Faber to contemplate the future of the family, like, no, he doesn't. He meets with them and says, yeah, I'm moving on. You know, you can take him now. And, you know, this compared to in the first season, you know, where there's all this, you know, sexual tension and he's having fist fights with Mike and trying to hang on to his family, and you know, it's like, you know, yeah, but now it's like, you know, yeah, okay, fine.
Well, yeah, that's exactly the same problem that we had in the previous episode, because we were saying the same thing, that, oh, yes, the marriage is falling apart, and they just kind of go, well, see you later. Yeah. Okay. Dana's having a tantrum. Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. She does that all the time.
That's what was weird was that, I think they did manage to do an amazing reboot in the second half, but what was annoying was even in the first half of the episode, there were chances to do it, and they just were completely dropping the ball on that part still. I was very happy that they did bring it around, and it was kind of an interesting contrast, where last season going into the finale, it was kind of like thinking like, I had no idea how they were going to sort of meld all those elements back into a satisfying finale. And they pulled it off brilliantly. And, I was just sort of feeling mind blown at the end of that, at the end of season one. And then with this one, it was sort of like the sense of relief of like, oh, okay, you have gotten things back on track. And, yes, now I am looking forward to seeing next season. But, it was, sort of a rough road to get there.
I'll be honest. I mean, even if it had ended with just one big episode, like the endless conversation in the cabin that was the first half of this one, still think that I would have been looking forward to next season, if only because it had to end eventually. I mean, the sun had to come up at some point. The conversation was going to end. It is unfortunate that the season took such a long sideways journey here. I'm scoring this a little generously because of that second half.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like that football game where you watch your team just completely getting, three scores behind in the first half, and then they roar back and win at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give it an 8.
Mm-hmm.
It should have been a 10, except for that first 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. I mean, I was thinking of an 8 as well, but more in terms of like, well, half of it was 6 to 7, half of it was 9 to 10. So
yeah,
there you go. Right in the middle, so.
Okay, how about you, Brunstone?
Yeah, I'm going to be unoriginal and go an 8 as well. It just there was that potential. I mean, that second half could have put it over the top completely if they'd handled it a bit different. That second half definitely redeemed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that this season is coming in right around an 8.3, which I think is pretty close to what we gave the first season as well, but it had a lot of potential to be much higher.
Yeah.
And if they hadn't had that looking like almost a 5 or 6 episode skid after Q&A, they probably would have stayed up in the high 8s rather than closer to just above average. But at the same time, it almost brings me back to Haven, in that we've got a show that can and does have the ability to hit those high numbers, but just was not consistent this season. It's almost like there were two different seasons going on. The first half and then the second, that was much, much better than the second half. So kind of the inverse of what the finale turned out to be.
It must be very thought-provoking.
Yes, I'm sure it is. When you're dealing with the apocalypse, sometimes you've got some...
it's a little distracting.
You have to take a moment to reflect.
Yes. That's an awfully large tentacle. Yeah.
Reflect, comprehend, chop, clean up.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...